Jack Gorisco, CSC Can-Am Steel.
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks for coming in today.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Join us on the Irregardless podcast. And tell me, Jack, what is CSC Can-Am Steel and what do you do there?
All right. So, hey, Can-Am Steel, or as we brand ourselves, CSC, we're solely focused on joist girder and metal deck industry in the U.S. So, hey, we have 7 manufacturing plants. We do projects across the nation, you know. And like I said, hey, I mean, we focus just on the joist, just on the metal deck. We participate roughly in about 3,000 projects every year. You know, we process 300,000 tons of steel, structural steel, and coil. We have been an independent company for last 5 years. So we used to be owned by a Canadian parent company, Can-Am, but then we were spun off about 5 years ago, which was a great timing for us, you know, because that's when the COVID boom happened with the warehousing industry. But yeah, so hey, as such, we focus just on joist deck. So the business model is pretty simple. My role at CSC is I'm the engineering director. So I lead 100 plus person team of drafters and engineers. And pretty much my role is about, it's a combination of, you know, strategic planning, strategic resource planning with day-to-day problem solving. And I like to focus on essentially eliminating bottlenecks, right? To allow the team to perform their best at their best level. I've been with the company for about 3 years and, you know, it's been fun. It's been fun.
You just commented on a lot there. So you are a structural, are you by education, a structural engineer? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So a couple of things that we hear get thrown around is civil engineers and structural engineers. So let me just back up a little bit. So are those one and the same or are those two different things?
It's one major in the college, but they're like separate subsets of civil engineering, right? So, hey, let's say one emphasis of civil engineering is transportation engineering, you know, which is the roadway designs, you know, the bridges and what have you. Another one could be environmental. You know, another one could be just, you know, the civil, you know, planning of the water resources, you know, what have you. But then structural is just focusing on the structural designs.
Okay. And so did you make it, as you were going through school, do you have to start to focus on these things? Or is that something that happens more in the work, as you work?
In the school, you focus at your junior level, you know, you start selecting some classes that want to put you on that track. You kind of have an idea. So, hey, funny, because first when I went into civil engineering school, I just wanted to be a civil engineer, maybe focus on transportation. There was one class that changed my mind, which was structural analysis. And honestly, the one class that I liked so much, and it sort of came naturally to me, I'm like, okay, maybe we should rethink it. Maybe we should try something different. And I did. And I'm not regretting that choice.
So what was it that came naturally to you?
The structural analysis essentially calculating how forces distribute in structures, right? So if you imagine a metal frame or a building frame, you know, how the forces distribute, you know, how they find their way from the roof all the way to the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And while some other students struggled with that, for me, it was just very natural. I was able to visualize it, right? Before even, you know, putting a pencil to the paper, I was able to see, okay, how those forces will find their way to the foundation, you know, how the axial forces will behave in the structure. So, like I said, hey, that was the one thing that really swayed me towards that structural
engineering. You're like looking around the room, you're like, I got all you beat. You're over there seeing in Technicolor in your head. So when we talk about structural engineering, it seems like there are different approaches. When you dump out of school and you're going out into the workforce, there's, I guess you could be a structural engineer more in the manufacturing world, or you could be more in sort of a contractor position, meaning that an EPC or somebody, a company would hire you to design and make them a bridge.
Exactly.
Or you could actually just be the manufacturer of like joists and decks.
Sure.
So tell me about that, how that all sort of lays out in the in the structural engineering world.
Hey, so I would say the typical career path for a structural engineer is to go work for a consulting engineering company, right? And what that means is, all the major companies out there, you know, the Jacobs, the AECOMs, or some smaller, design engineering firms. They're essentially like contractors, right? Subcontractors to the project, right? Because they design the project, right? They're the product that they do, that they offer to the market, is their calculations, their drawings, their specifications, right? So it's that intellectual property. This is what they sell to their customer, whether it's a developer or an owner of a building or a structure.
I'm a consultant, by the way.
Consultants,
so they're more,
yes.
They're consultants,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So, like I said, the product that they sell is more of the intellectual product, right? The designs, the drawings, the specifications, and that's what the firm bills their customers for, right? So that's the elementary difference between consulting engineering and manufacturing. Because if you're an engineer in a manufacturing organization, like myself, we do not sell our designs. We do not sell our drawings to the customers. That's just a mean to an end, right? Hey, mm-hmm. we have to create our designs in order to produce our product. But essentially our company gets paid when the raw material, the steel, the structural steel, is to turn into an actual product, which, in our case is joists, steel joists, and metal deck. So as such, we don't just focus on getting the designs correct, but we're also exposed to all of the manufacturing aspects of the organization, right? We have to be mindful of the production schedules. We have to be mindful of material availability. We have to be really, for us to succeed as a company, we have to have that commercial mindset, where at times, we have to make tough calls, make some tough calls, some tough decisions, to make sure that the project stays on track. Let's say if we're having a hard time getting some information from one of the subs on the project, let's say sprinkler supplier or mechanical supplier, we don't want to upset our customers. We've committed to the delivery. We have to make some, some tough choices. At other times, we have to be maybe extra accommodating to the customer changing needs, which, at times are ever changing. So that's the difference, right? So, the pace is definitely different. As an engineer or drafter or detailer in a company like ours, you sort of focus on a very limited scope, but you churn. Being good at it means you're doing it quickly, efficiently, and in a manner that's easy for us to fabricate. So
we were talking about this before, and I commented, what you guys are doing is, maybe the consulting company is the one who's building a NASCAR, an F1 car, an Indy car. They've been brought to a project like, build us the best this type of car. And you guys are kind of more like in NASCAR, which you have a platform that you have to absolutely master. And you're trying to think, okay, we know how to make this already, but how do we make it faster given these constraints? Right. So you have certain constraints in your manufacturing and you're sitting there like, okay, can we remove a bolt? Can we, can we put more wedge or whatever in to make this thing drive faster? And you guys are probably looking at your manufacturing process, like throughput capacities, optimal heat or whatever for bending, things like that, that without sacrifice to your product makes your operation better.
Hey, that's spot on. That's great analogy. And I would say that's another difference, between the typical, consulting engineering path and being an engineer, in that manufacturing environment is because, so let's say for us, I'll use that example. We joke that we have two modes. We have a summer mode and we have a winter mode. Summer mode is when the demand is high and the customers are actually, the project schedules stick. The customers are actually demanding, they're trying to make sure that we hit the dates, right? Because the construction projects are going on. At that time, you know, we're limited by the throughput of our plants, right? So at that time, it doesn't really make sense for us to be trying to shave every pound of steel out of our products, out of joists. You know, hey, we at that time, we focus on efficiency both on the engineering side, you know, so that we can design and release more projects. And we also focus on the manufacturing efficiency, right? So that the shop can produce more products. But then on the flip side, there's a winter mode when the demand is not as high, right? At that time, okay, when we're not limited by that manufacturing capacity, hey, what's the best decision for the company? Well, it's maybe to spend a little bit more time, more shop labor time, you know, to produce a product, but save the material, you know, save extra few pounds of steel.
Those are really different things.
They are. So there's a little bit of an art, you know, in engineering judgment, you know, that comes into play. But yeah, they are drastically different things.
That's interesting. So let me wind the clock back a little bit here, okay. Which is, as you're talking before, because I'm keenly observant and perceptive.
Yes, you are.
I noticed that you have an accent. I wanted to know where were you born? Where are you from? What's your backstory?
All right. So my accent comes from Poland. Okay. I was born and raised in Poland, South Poland, actually, near the border with Czech Republic.
Okay.
It was not very far. Then I went to college in Krakow, which, hey, by far is the best city on earth. I highly recommend.
It's the capital, correct?
It used to be, yeah. Okay. Warsaw is the capital now.
Okay, thank you for giving me credit for what it used to be.
But hey, there's a great castle. There's a, you know, hey, the kings used to live there in Krakow before they decided to move to Warsaw.
which castle? Is that the big, like, huge white castle?
No, I don't think it's white. No, it's more on the red.
Yeah, rig. Totally wrong. Okay, it's fine. So you grew up in Poland, you were in Krakow.
Yep.
And you went to school there.
Yes, to college. Yep.
Okay, and you and then we were talking about you came to the U.S. in a green card capacity in 2004.
2004. Yes.
So how did you get from? I mean, you said you were what, 20-ish?
I was 22 at the time.
Okay, 22. So relative. I mean, as compared to us today, relatively young.
Yes.
So how did all that come about?
Briefly speaking, by accident. Hey, okay. So a few things led to it. I was, like I said, I was in college. I was studying civil engineering at that time. Poland was doing okay, but, you know, we were still sort of this, you know, I don't know, second class type of country in the Europe. It didn't seem like there was that many opportunities. So really, a lot of people my age were thinking about leaving Poland and, you know, going west. But hey, what happened for me is that out of total black, hey, just one day I saw an ad in a newspaper that, you know, hey, I can apply for a green card.
Literally in a newspaper.
Yeah. And
it's unbelievable.
What the heck? Like, hey, I went to the office, you know, it was some kind of travel agency. I had no idea how this stuff works, by the way. Because, hey, you know, it's literally like buying a lottery ticket, right? So, hey, the U.S. government does the lottery every year, you know, they accept applicants from across the world. At that year, I think they had about 20 million submissions, and they selected about 50,000 people.
Is it literally a lottery? Like,
it is, yeah. Hey, there are some minimum requirements that you have to meet. You know, obviously they want to bring some, you know, certain level quality people, you know.
Right.
But yeah, it is a lottery.
But once you clear those prerequisites, it's a drawing?
Yeah, yep.
Okay.
So, hey, then, like I said, didn't know much about it, forgot about
Did
it.
Did you forget about it?
Oh yeah, totally. So it was actually like next summer. Hey, next summer, what did I do? Okay, I went to London actually. I traveled to London trying to find some work, you know, summer work, you know, for vacation time, you know, trying to make some money. And the second day I get there, my brother calls me. He's like, hey, there's a weird letter. It came from US. It's like, hey, we open it. Did you like apply for a green card? Yeah, I think I did. All right, you won. Okay.
I mean, that's a big piece of news. Like, even if you wanted to go or not go, like, that's a big decision.
Hey, definitely. It was a big decision. But
what was your reaction at the time? Were you like, I got a guy on the other line about some white walls, or were you pretty excited?
No. Hey, I was like, right on. That's great. Hey, let's make it happen. So at that time, I was like really interested. Like, okay, what do I need to do to actually make it happen? And then, you know, about a year ago, you know, I packed my backpack. You know, I got $1,000 in my pocket, and I ended up coming to St. Louis.
Okay, so hold on. So do you remember like exactly where you were when you were talking to your brother on the phone?
In London.
You were in London. You were in London. So you found out, and this is summertime, and you found out, so you end up going, when did you wait till your summer was over?
Oh, no. I changed my return ticket. So at that time, you know, flying was still a little bit pricey. So, you know, it was taking a bus, which was like a 30-hour journey, you know, to travel across to Europe.
Yeah.
Hey, I came back, and the rest is history.
So did you go back to Poland? Yep. You went back home, grabbed your stuff?
No, it was a little bit more complicated than that. Hey, okay. You have to go through the process. You have to go to the interview, to the embassy, you know, to talk, to get cleared. You know, they have to do all kinds of background checks on you. You know, they have to check your health, you know, you have to take some vaccines. But like, so that process took about a year. And then like the next summer, I actually came here. That was 2004.
That's remarkable because were you scared?
You know, maybe deep inside a little bit, but honestly, it's like, hey, you know, I'm young. Like, what's the worst thing that can happen?
You're
like,
I can always come back, I guess.
Exactly. That was my reasoning. It's like, hey, you know, that's the cards that I was handled.
Yeah.
Hey, it's an opportunity. It's a lottery. I have to take advantage of that. And like you said, hey, the worst thing that could possibly happen, I'll just pack my bag and go back home and say, hey, mom, can I come back?
So had you told your mom that you'd, or is this something you just kind of did? You went down and threw your name in. Did you tell anybody? Or you just kind of did that. And then next thing you know, there's a letter at the house. You're in London. They open it. Did your mom have a comment?
She wasn't excited. Maybe she didn't believe that I would actually follow through.
Okay.
that's probably what she thought. But yeah.
And you're like, see ya.
Pretty much.
So you went through all of kind of the, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? But you did all the tests and stuff.
Yeah.
And everything got checked out. And then why St. Louis? How did you choose St. Louis?
Great question. So, hey, I'll just make a comment that let's say if you live outside of US, you know, there are maybe three or four cities that everybody knows. It's LA, New York, Miami, and I guess maybe Chicago, because that's where all the movies take place.
Sure. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Makes sense.
So, hey, they didn't really want to go to New York. Some people, you know, convinced me to not go to Miami or Chicago. And it just so happened that my distant cousin lived here in St. Louis. So that was
how
at
distant,
least,
like, well, marriage by marriage?
Actually, not that distant, just a cousin. But, you know, but he was here. I didn't know him very well. I mean, I knew him, but like not super well. So, hey, you know, it was definitely much easier because when I landed, there was actually someone to pick me up at the airport, and I had a place to crash, you know, for the first week before I found a room.
Had you met him before?
Yeah.
Is he from Poland?
Yes.
Okay. So it wasn't somebody who'd moved a generation before or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
No. So he came maybe about a year before me in a similar way, actually.
Unbelievable. Okay, so maybe was this a plan to get rid of the Gorskos? Like they're like, well, these Gorskos keep winning the lottery.
Probably some kind of a glitch or something, you know?
Unbelievable. So he picked you up at Lambert. He flew in and he met you there.
Yes.
And that was in 2004.
2004, yep.
Okay, so you got here and did you kind of hang at his place for like, were you on the couch for a bit?
For about a week before I found a room for rent, and then, you know, he helped me buy a first car, because obviously if there's one thing about the U.S., I'd rather be without legs than without a car, right?
Right, you got to get around.
You got to get around, yeah. So.
And so you, but when you showed up, did you already have an engineering degree?
No.
Did you have what was the equivalent of an undergraduate degree, or what did you have from an education? Because you've taken a lot of classes in your life, and you have many degrees at this point. So what did you show up with?
Nothing. I mean, okay. I've had like 3 years completed at that time, but but that wasn't really equivalent to anything. It was not a degree. So, hey, you know, did some jobs, you know, to get myself through the college here, you know, and I got my bachelor's in civil engineering, and that's how it happened, actually. So, hey, you know, I graduated in 2007. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, but 2007, 2008 was the beginning of something pretty bad.
Yeah, the housing crisis.
Yes, yeah. So pretty scary time for engineers and, you know, construction workers alike.
Yeah, it works a little slow during this, you know, during those years.
A little slow, yeah.
It was gone.
Yep. So, hey, I was very fortunate. I remained employed throughout the time. That's mainly because the company that I was working for at that time as a structural engineer, as a consultant structural engineer. We did not have any projects in the US, but we had one big project in Kuwait. It was a brand new cement plant that we were designing. It was a huge project. And that's really what carried us through, you know, 2008, 2009 into 2010, when the market finally started turning around.
Really? God, how lucky.
Yeah.
That was, because those were bad times for a lot of people in that world.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I mean, you know, some of my colleagues, I mean, they just started working at, like, you know, Home Depot or whatever, you know, just
doing
whatever.
Anywhere you get money. Yeah. Did you go to Kuwait as part of that?
I did not. No,
you didn't?
No, I did not. Okay. I've done some other international travels for other job sites, but not to Kuwait.
where else has the engineering taken you then?
Consulting engineering, right? This is how I started. It was a company that was focusing on more of industrial mining type of projects, but I was always curious about stuff outside of my role, right? So, hey, as a structural engineer, I would still hang out with, let's say, mechanical engineers to learn about mechanical equipment, to learn about the process. I would hang out with construction managers, you know, to understand the basics of constructions. And that really prepared me well for my next role, mm-hmm. Where I took over engineering department for a conveyor manufacturing company here in town.
Just the conveyance of, like, things?
So not just things. It was bulk material handling, like rock, sand, grain. So not what you would see in a, let's say, in Amazon warehouse, you know, where your packages run on conveyors. Mm-hmm. It was the rock, heavy stuff.
Right, okay. The man stuff.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, got it.
And that was actually quite an interesting setup, because it was an umbrella, or under one umbrella, there were three separate companies. You know, the design manufacturing, there was an equipment dealer, and also a construction company, right?
Okay.
So even though we worked somewhat independently under one ownership, at times we came together and we were able to provide a design build solution to the customer. And that's mainly in the mining industry, which I should be more specific. In the Midwest, there is pretty much the only mining that's happening is quarries, right? Aggregates, rock, limestone, sand. So for that industry, or for bulk material handling, so us being in St. Louis, you know, we have the mighty Mississippi River.
Yes.
If you look at the Mississippi River, you'll see barges going up and down.
Yes.
There is tremendous amount of grain, of corn, soybeans that are loaded in St. Louis on the barges, and they are shipped to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've done some of those conveyors.
And those are for export ultimately?
Yeah.
If they're going to New Orleans?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes.
Okay.
So we built some of those ports. One special place is in Cahokia. I don't know if you're ever on I-55. You look east, there's a big port, there's a big dome, there's a lot of conveyors. So we built that port.
I will notice the next time, because I do drive past that at least, I bet you, 3 or 4 times a year.
Okay.
So I'll have to yeah, take a look.
So yeah, we've done some of those ports out there. And hey, those were definitely fun projects. You know, a lot of coordination, you know, with water levels, you know, with everything else. And these are like super high capacity type of conveyors. You know, if you imagine a barge that holds maybe 2,000 tons, hey, they would like to get it loaded in 1 hour, right? So
that's... insanely fast.
So there's a lot of trucks, a lot of trains that come. They, I think they have capacity maybe to unload like, you know, some 3,000 trucks during the day. And then they're unloading trains at night. So yeah, I mean, just the amount of stuff that they put in general in St. Louis on barges, it's insane, definitely insane.
Yeah, it's that all happens very quietly, doesn't it? I mean, when you're not in that
world. When you're not paying attention, yeah, that's for sure.
It's kind of like light bulbs or something. We don't think about them. They're just here.
Yeah, yeah.
And just don't think about it too much. So you came over. You were 20, 24 years old. You got the job. You get through the housing crisis.
Yep.
Where did you go after that? What was the move?
So after the conveyor company about 3 years ago, I got the opportunity to join CSC, Can-Am Steel, right?
Okay.
And that was great timing for me at that time. I was picking up, you know, reaching my peak at the conveyor company, and this opportunity came. Obviously concerned a little bit because up until that time, my background, all my career has been in industrial design, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, mining, industrial design. So I was definitely new to the joist and deck industry and commercial construction in general. So there was a little bit of unknown there, but at the same time, going back to my experience, the role of engineers at the manufacturing company, at the conveyor company, was essentially the same as the role of engineers at CSC, at Can-Am Steel, because we're a manufacturing company, right? So
mm-hmm.
again, you know, we're not just selling our designs, we're selling actual product, right? So some of the manufacturing concept have already
transferred
been known to me.
Yeah, and then what about management? Had you said you've got about a 100-person team. Was that a new part for you, or had you been managing sizable teams already?
Not that sizable. So my team at the conveyor company was much smaller, considerably much smaller. The challenge, part of the challenge of the opportunity is like,
so,
all of a sudden, yeah, totally different size.
How'd you approach that? Because I remember my first kind of foray into management is it can be a little uncomfortable.
You know, it could be, but at the same time, I'm very fortunate because the direct reports or people that report to me directly, they're crazy good. I mean,
okay.
They have a lot of experience. They work well together. That makes a lot of difference, you know, because if you're trying to manage some crises, you know, some personalities, that would make it a lot more difficult. But hey, my group is genuinely self-motivated. They like what they're doing. They're very good at what they're doing. So that definitely makes it a lot easier on my end.
Let me ask you this. So as you're managing, I mean, you have direct reports but your general overall size group is, you know, 100 or so people. How do you think about management? When you think about the concept of management, what is sort of your paradigm? Like, this is how I believe management should be occurring. Like, your style, or what is your sort of criteria, not criteria, but how do you think about this?
Well,
like, let me give you an example.
On different levels.
Go ahead. I was just say, you know, there's kind of the hard and fast. Look, you either have the people or the process. One of them is the problem. And then, so if it's the process, you look at the process. People, you look at the people and find out where the problem exists. And you can either, at that point, if you figure out as people, you're like, okay, is it time to help grow that person into what I know they can be? Or is it like, well, bottom line is you're not getting done what I need you to get done. And I'm just going to find someone who can. So there are different ways to approach different things, and some are more autocratic versus permissive.
Okay, so I would say one thing. Hey, the job market for engineers, drafters, detailers have been really good in the last several years. So we've had challenge growing the team. And not only there was a challenge of finding the right people to join the team, to grow the team, which definitely there was a need for that. It takes years to develop someone into a very productive, you know, resource for us. It's not like in consulting, engineering company again, you know, hey, if you know how to design buildings, whether you work for company A or company B or company C, you pretty much, hey, as you switch jobs, you're productive from day one. For us, it's anybody can design a truss, any structural engineer can design a truss, but to do it right, that takes time and practice, that takes some personality. So you know, those little nuances that's what takes time to developing those people. So that was one of the challenges. Hey, you know, we've been growing the team because as the market exploded, you know, during the COVID era, the warehouse boom, mm-hmm. I mean, the jobs were plentiful. We've had a lot of projects, but those were typically very easy projects for us from the engineering standpoint, you know, where then, you know, in 2022, the markets, you know, the warehousing has definitely cooled off. We've started getting into more complex work. So, hey, that's when we needed more resources. So hiring and building the teams, that was definitely part of the challenge that I've tried to tackle. And then, hey, to address your question about the management style, hey, I would say I'm definitely on the permissive side.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's say that one of the management, not necessarily management concepts, but one idea that I really like is, I'm sure you might have heard about it, is the event plus response equals outcome.
Mm-hmm.
The E plus R equals O, right? So, hey, you know, we don't control the events, right? Events, what's happening a lot of times is outside of our control. But what we control is how we respond to the event, right? So let's say if something happens, you know, whether it's a market condition, you know, equipment breakdown, or if somebody just makes a mistake, okay, it has been happening, it is happening, it will be happening. But how we can really make a difference as managers or as business leaders is how we respond to those situations, you know, and that will dictate the outcome. So that is definitely an idea that's very close to my heart, whether it's, you know, whether it's professionally or, you know, stuff at home, it's how you respond to the situation, you know, because, hey, things outside of your control, they already happened, you know. It's how you respond to them. It's really what will dictate the outcome. And that really ties, I think, to stoicism.
Yes. Right?
The Stoics, you know.
Yes.
Some 2,000 years ago, they pretty much, you know, said the same thing, you know. It's like, hey, you know, focus on what's within your control.
Yes.
And let go of what you cannot control, right? That's the recipe for, you know, happier life. Not necessarily happy, but at least happier life.
Yeah. I put an emphasis on the evaluation, though, of what can be controlled and what cannot, as much as what you should let go of. And I mean, I would imagine that if there was a really highly scrutinized evaluation of what can be controlled and what cannot, it would be amazing how small the control list would be.
Sure. Yeah.
you know, be like, I came up with this one thing that I can actually control.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just how I respond to things.
Sure. Sure.
You know, so I fully agree with that. And the problem being that, you know, most people subscribe to perhaps the same thing, but slight variations of the same things. And, you know, that can be the rub sometimes, is that, yeah, we agree on conceptually the same thing, but, you know, we are all practitioners and maybe practicing in a slightly different way.
Sure. So here's another idea. It's, where was it? I think Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I don't know if you read that book.
No, I know who he is.
So, hey, when I was reading that book, I got the light bulb. It's the idea that he was explaining is, hey, how we explain things it really comes down to how our brains are wired, right? So, hey, you know, the planning, the ideas, that really comes out of our limbic brain, I believe.
The limbic system, I believe.
The limbic system, yes.
Yeah.
Right, but that limbic system is not responsible for language, right? There's, I believe,
is that the Wernicke's?
Forgetting the term.
Anyway,
not a biologist by any means, but anyway, so there are like two different parts of your brain, right, that are responsible for different things, and I would say that engineers typically have the limbic brain more developed, and that's why.
Is this kind of the left brain, right brain kind of thing?
A little bit like this, yeah.
Yeah.
Where, you know, hey, I can have an idea, I can have a plan, And it makes perfect sense in my head. But then all of a sudden I have troubles explaining it to everyone, explaining it in a way that, you know, that's understandable, right? So when I was reading that, we were like, oh my God, this is actually what's happening to me. It's like, okay, so how okay. can I overcome that?
So you thought that you realized maybe that what's in here, you're just not getting it out of your mouth or not writing it or whatever correctly.
Exactly,
or more effectively.
Yeah.
So you had the realization?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's a big deal. So what'd you do?
Okay, so the way for me to overcome that is writing. Essentially, you know, just writing my thoughts down, you know, that slows down my thinking process. You know, I think more clearly. And once I write something down, it's like, okay, then I can take a step back and see, okay, does it really make sense? So that's one of the ways that, you know, I've approached it, just trying to make sure that, you know, hey, I can control my thoughts, my ideas. And
this wasn't, you're speaking to more of how you're wired versus like, how great's your English, right? You're not talking about that. You're talking about how you think.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you probably spoke English well before you got here.
If
you were in London.
I wouldn't say so, but hey, I've stopped worrying about my English, my pronunciation, my grammar a long time ago. At first, you know,
so there was definitely. So this is all about how you're wired.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So you found that just kind of rehearsing your thinking.
Yep. Yep.
It was a really good way for you to do that.
Yep.
Can you think of somebody who wouldn't benefit from that?
I don't think that everybody necessarily needs that. I would say, you know, that maybe the engineering-minded people, you know, hey, there's a reason why a lot of engineers are perceived to not be great communicators. You know, they kind of live in their world. Mm-hmm. So I think this is where it's really helpful. But then...
Well, this is interesting. So what is an engineer's mind? So... What I mean is, what I think comes to the mind of a lot of people is just mathematics, okay? Where engineer, they're slide rulers and, you know, just, you know, number crunching for load capacities and moment, all that. So, but that's just an expression of how you're using your brain, right? That's a modality.
Yep.
So what is the engineer's brain?
I would say it's constant overthinking.
Uh-huh.
It's risk aversion.
Okay.
Right? Hey, you're really risk averse. I mean, hey, if you think about it, okay, let's go back to the structural engineering education.
Okay.
You know, what they teach you at school is, let's say, structural steel design. It's they teach you ways in which structural steel can fail, right? So let's say, you know, how connection can fail, how beam can fail, how column can fail. And as long as you prevent those failure modes from happening, your structure is good, right? So we're naturally we're indoctrinated to thinking like, okay, hey, things gonna fail. I have to make sure that I prevent that from happening, right? So that's the risk aversion part. And at the same time, we're well aware that at no situation in time we have all the information that we need to make the right decision, right? So there is element of guessing. There is element of, you know, just going with your gut.
Yeah. So. And so how do you calculate that? I mean, is that actually calculated? Meaning that for a given structure, here's what we can quantitatively know, and there's a level of uncertainty or there's a confidence level. Like, I think this will hold. And then you're going to ask me like, think like 50%, 60%?
Okay, I would say when you're designing a new structure, the confidence level should be about 100% and not less. No.
Right, yeah.
It becomes a lot more difficult, you know, where, let's say when you're evaluating something existing, right? At that time, you have to make some guesses. You know, hopefully you're being conservative with your assumptions.
How can you walk around town? Like, everything around us has been engineered.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so you go to like the arch or you go to a baseball game and you're looking at railings and you're looking at, do you notice all of that?
No, not really. Because, hey, you know, there's a certain level of fudge factors, you know, built uh-huh. into it. I'll tell you what I worry about.
You mean things being over-engineered for the sake of safety?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. I'm more worried about like getting on an airplane and like thinking like, okay, that guy, whenever he was designing the airplane, okay, did he What kind of struggle did that person have?
Yeah, so is there, yeah, so things that are terrestrial, like railings and things like that, there's not really probably a weight issue.
Yeah.
That you, I mean, with an airplane, there are so many constraints about that design.
Yeah.
And so you get on the airplane, is there a particular part of the airplane that comes to your mind? You're like, you know enough about building airplanes to be dangerous, so you're like, you're wondering, did they get that right? The whole damn thing?
Just the whole damn thing. I would say just the whole damn thing. I would say just making sure that their quality assurance process was better than in a lot of the other engineering firms.
Oh, so you're like, I know enough about engineering in general to understand that there may be things on this plane that were not as scrutinized as that I maybe would have liked.
Because the design had to be completed by Friday, you know, so they completed it by Friday, but maybe it wasn't checked, you know.
So so are you uneasy on an airplane?
No. I say it somewhat jokingly, but, you know, it's just to maybe show the point, like, hey, you know, there are processes I'm really hoping that, you know, that every engineer follows. But at the same time, it's like, okay, what if not?
So when you go on a road trip around the United States, I don't mean this in a political context. I mean this just in, do you feel that it's true or not true? Like, you're driving under an overpass and you see the concrete's, you know, chipping off. Like, there are some bridges in St. Louis. I drive over and I do like the sign of the cross before I go over that bridge, because I hope it's going to hold me. And so, do you feel like there is some neglect as far as there are some maintenance needs to be done? We hear about it a lot. So I just didn't know if you know these things. So when you drive past it, what are you thinking, like, ugh, I could use a little help?
We do. There's definitely some neglect in terms of, you know, the infrastructure, the maintenance. But I personally do not worry about it too much. Again, I'm just coming from the standpoint, it's like, hey, you know, there's enough safety factors built in. And I've seen, this may not be the right thing to say, but I've seen some crazy stuff out there, you know, on the job sites, especially outside of US. You know, so I visited some job sites, some construction sites, you know, outside of US, you know, let's say like in Caribbean, where safety, you know, was not necessarily the priority. And I've seen that things are built in like a really weird way, but somehow they hold up. So I feel like, hey, you know, there's definitely a lot of the safety factors built in into the structural world. So, hey, and here's the proof. I mean, things are just not falling down left and right, you know. They really don't, unless like there is some kind of catastrophic event, you know.
Right.
They really hold up.
So that Mythbusters, where that bridge broke because the natural harmonic of the bridge, the resonance, just made the whole thing vibrate and just crumble.
Yeah. Hey, I've not been involved with bridges, but in my past life at the conveyor, you know, company, we've designed a lot of structures for vibrating equipment, you know, like crushers, screens. And it's amazing because, hey, you can design your structure to be rigid, but you have a piece of equipment here, but then you're like, I don't know, three stories higher, all of a sudden, you know, your handrail might be shaking like this, you know, because of the harmonics and how that works. So
yeah, and that's sometimes you don't know that till you turn it on.
Oh, you never know. You never know. Some of those little things are like, okay, hey, the structure's holding up, but, you know, hey, maybe you should weld that handrail, you know, to something, add some rigidity to it, because it's just bouncing up and down.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to account for. I guess they know. I mean, the libraries of harmonics is probably pretty well built out at this point, and how to manage those sound waves going through materials and what can be dampeners or insulators against those waves.
Yeah.
But you just don't want to get in a situation where you have wave construction. You know, where things start to get sort of a little out of hand.
Yep.
So let me pivot a little bit, which is, what is the future in your mind of structural engineering in the context of computing power, specifically how artificial intelligence can help the world of structural engineering? And do you also see any sort of things that you would consider threats? And I don't mean necessarily in terms of like, oh, it's going to take our jobs, which maybe you're about to say, but also as far as the quality of what it's doing.
Sure. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time researching the AI, you know, on a professional level, but honestly, like in the immediate future, I don't see that as a threat. Hey, there's definitely some low-hanging fruit as far as the usage of AI. So let's say for a company like ours, that would be help with estimation. Hey, we do roughly 3,000 projects every year, but we estimate about 30,000, right? So so there's big churn of estimates that we do pretty much every day. So we have been looking into ways to use AI with help, right? So hey, AI could read the drawings, the structural drawings that we receive from the customer, you know, create some automated bills of materials based on those drawings. But as far as the design side, I don't know. Right now I don't have a good vision that it would be a threat to us, you know, at least not in the near future. At the same time, I would like to say that we are undergoing some technological, you know, changes at our company. We are developing actually brand new software. You know, hey, I know you're in a software business essentially.
Yes.
We are developing brand new drafting and engineering software. So, hey, the programs that we currently have, they work very well, but they don't really talk to each other, right? So, hey, so there's one program for drafting, there's one program for design, there's one program for detailing. As a result, there's a lot of redundancy on the, you know, drafting and engineering front because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the data have to be entered, essentially the same data have to be entered into multiple programs. But, hey, like I said, we are in the process of developing a brand new program and that software suite will include everything, you know, from drafting through load takedown, design engineering, detail engineering, and obviously, you know, it'll talk with our ERP system.
Mm-hmm.
So that is huge. Hey, that's very exciting stuff. It's kind of painful to go through the process. It's totally
costs painful.
A lot of money.
it's expensive and a lot of people don't enjoy the process.
So I'm not directly involved with this. Hey, we have a separate group, but hey, it's just super exciting because, hey, once that comes to fruition, I feel like, you know, it'll be revolutionary for us. Not only it's going to make us more efficient from the drafting and engineering standpoint, you know, in terms of drafting and engineering effort, it'll also improve our customer service because, hey, we'll be able to create approval drawings sooner. We'll be able to create designs sooner. Hey, we'll be able to get better BIM models, you know, 3D models for the projects. Hey, there's going to be fewer errors. Hey, you know, we make errors sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So definitely that is very exciting thing for us. That's happening.
That is exciting to have kind of the latest and greatest. Because yeah. You know, if to see these companies embracing like what we're doing at Brizos or what you guys are doing, I think it's all progress in the right direction because there's just no way that this isn't going to continue. So companies smartly, you know, bringing on softwares that help them be the best version of themselves is a good idea.
Yep.
So in kind of wrapping things up, there are a couple of things. One question occurred to me. Have you been back to Poland?
Uh-huh.
You have?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been back. And then how do people find your company if they want to reach out to you and find more about what you guys do or your products?
Sure. Hey, so yeah, I still have family in Poland, you know, my brother, my sister, their families, you know, my mom. So I try to go there, you know, every couple of years. And hey, one thing I have to say is in the last 20 years, Poland has seen tremendous economic growth. I mean, yeah, it's truly a success story. You know, we joined European Union in 2004 and with that, we received a lot of foreign investment.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, Poland has really become the manufacturing base for Europe. You know, there's a lot of automotive electronics and, hey, you know, standard of living has increased greatly. And at the same time, I have to mention one more thing. It's a very safe country, right? We don't have some of the personal safety concerns like, you know, some of the Western countries, you know, UK, France, Spain. So, hey, great, great, great place to visit, you know, if you're ever
beautiful
looking for a way. Yep. And then as far as the, hey, CSC, Canam Steel, definitely, hey, you know, we have a website, CSC Steel USA. You know, you can find out more about our company. And hey, me personally, I'm not on Twitter or X or whatever it's called nowadays, but I am somewhat active on LinkedIn. So hey, if there are any, you know, engineering-minded people that would like to have a conversation, you know, feel free to look me up on LinkedIn and, you know, let's chat.
All right. So reach out to Jack Gorsko at CSC Can-Am Steel on LinkedIn. He'd like to hear from you. And Jack, thanks for coming in today. Hey, I really appreciate it. It's been fun catching up.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.